This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling.
This episode is brought to you by LifeLock. Between two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN, you try to be in control of how your info is protected. But many other places also have it, and they might not be as careful. That's why LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats. If your identity is stolen, they'll fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/podcast for 40% off. Terms apply.
Hey, Olivia from Ollie here to help you ease into all things back to school. Homework, meal prep, and pickup duty piling up? Goodbye Stress Gummies help you keep your cool. Start the day with Kids Multi and Probiotic for digestive and immune system health. They'll love to take them. And that makes mornings easier. When back to school gets real, Ollie helps you deal. Find these and more at Ollie.com or retailers nationwide. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. Brian Kilmeade Show moving through this week rapidly. Standing by Senator James Lankford. And then we'll be able to take a lot of calls and get perspective on what's going on in the news today, because there is a lot, including there's some events taking place. The president, we do know some scripted events. We know Senator Sanders has got a town hall, save public education. He wants to pay teachers more. I kind of like the idea of paying teachers more. I agree with him on that. And they're going to have the assassin. You know the guy who did the Sexton assassination attempt on Trump at the golf course, Ryan Ruth? He's going to appear in court today to see if he can get the right to defend himself. Evidently, there's a belief, believe it or not, that he's not all there. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
The narrative that paints this is a kind of binary situation, courage versus capitulation, is just wrong. It's too simplistic. This was a really, really complex problem.
That is Claire Shipman, the temporary or the acting head of Columbia. Columbia cuts a deal on higher education. Much needed reform has begun. The Ivy League writes a $200 million check to save their billions in grants and make their campus safe for all. I love it.
Number two.
Mostly we'll be charging straight tariffs to most of the rest of the world. That's a lot of deals. Even if you're like me, a deal junkie, that's a lot of deals.
And there we go. And maybe the EU today. Economic rocket ship. A week after a massive crypto investment comes a focus on AI and a record trade deal. Trump is in an economic role, but polls say Americans are not feeling it. We examine the deals and the disconnect.
Number one.
I'm leaving the criminal charges to the Department of Justice. I'm not an attorney, but as I've said previously, the expressed intent and what followed afterward can only be described as a years-long coup and a treasonous conspiracy.
That's the DNI director, Tulsi Gabbard. She takes aim at Obama and the left-wing intel surrogates while Dems suddenly find an intense interest in Epstein. And we have a movement on both stories, which seems to have all the media attention, even though if you want to know what people really care about and how it affects their lives, it's neither one of them. And you could add the Biden investigation, too. I do think we should find out about the auto pen. No question about it. But in terms of things that are going to impact American lives in 2025, not really. Senator James Lankford, the Homeland Security Intelligence Finance Committee, takes up a lot of his time. The lead negotiator on border security in that bill, the bipartisan bill earlier before the election. Senator, welcome back.
Hey, good to be back with you again, Brian.
So, Senator, how do you explain the disconnect? If I looked at the Japan deal, if I look at the Indonesia deal, if I look at the UK deal, the Filipino deal, Vietnam, I think the EU could be next. You see all this massive investments, especially in AI yesterday. I just talked to the one of the vice presidents at Meta, putting billions of dollars into new data facilities. Why do you think the American people don't seem to be feeling it yet?
Yeah, it takes a little while to be able to go through the process on this. This would be like if you were to build a house. The day you sign the paperwork to build the house, you're not living in the house. It's going to take you a year to be able to build it, to be able to get into it. The first day you're signing the paperwork for, it's a fun day, but you're still sleeping in the same place for a while until you get it done. So we're in that mode right now, signing the paperwork with Japan, signing with Indonesia. These are huge trade deals to be able to open up markets, even getting access to the beef market in Australia, which has been an issue for a long time. That's an ally and a friend, but they've not bought our beef. I mean, so there's a lot of different things that will dramatically affect our economy, but it's day one of signing the deal. It's going to take a little while to be able to actually feel it.
Here's Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, on the Japanese deal. Cut 12.
No tariffs on our automobiles, but more importantly, they had non-tariff barriers. So they had a lot of, you know, the Japanese are obsessed with safety. We do a pretty good job here, I think. And so ours, as long as a car meets our safety requirements, can now be sold in Japan. So that's a huge difference, not non-tariff trade barrier. And then President Trump negotiated the Japanese delegation up to a $550 billion, the package, loans, credit guarantees, and equity. And President Trump is going to direct where that can be invested. And that is going to be invested in the de-risking of our supply chains.
So with the $550 billion, they say it's going to function like a sovereign wealth fund. So you could decide, I want to invest in pharmaceuticals or rare earth here with the money. I've never heard anything like that. Have you?
No, I have not. That's a remarkable addition to any trade deal. But the focus of it is, if we're going to continue to be able to grow things like rare or things like pharmaceuticals, we've got to get greater investment to be able to do this. This gives access to capital to be able to move on those things. So, yeah, extremely helpful to be able to move. I would tell you the issue of cars was the biggest issue and the sticking point with Japan. Obviously, they sell a lot of cars in the United States and some great cars. We sell a lot of great cars in America. We have bought their cars, but they would not buy ours. That's about to change.
So I understand with the EU, their biggest complaint with us is our financial regulations. Could you explain that? I know you're on the Finance Committee.
Yeah. So there a couple of things with the EU on this. One is they don't like the fact that social media companies are mainly based in the United States. They've tried to be able to find some way to be able to do digital services taxes, any way they can get a chance to be able to tax Facebook, X, all of those platforms. They're always trying to be able to go after that. So that's one constant fight with them on the finance side of it. There's actually with ag products, they don't like the way that we actually grow our crops and what we do. We feed the world, and they don't like the process that we actually do it. And so there's a constant fight with the EU on that. They can't grow enough to sustain themselves. We can grow enough to be able to help them. And so that's another place where we're trying to be able to open up the markets as well with them. So it's the way we handle our finances. Our banks are very intertwined. We do a lot of similar things on banking. It's really some of the tax policy issues and our ag issues are the biggest sticking points.
So let's talk about the big, beautiful bill. I actually think it worked to your advantage to get it done by July 4th, that there were so many other big stories. So with the Iranian bombing and the Israel going at them for a few weeks in there, and obviously recognizing Syria, there was always seemed to be other news that would swap it. To me, it allowed you guys to work out the details amongst yourselves because you had no Democratic support. Yeah. But in the end, almost every poll I see, the highest I've seen in approval is 38%. So your goal is now what?
For people to learn what's actually in it. Democrats spent a couple of months saying this bill is all about billionaires and it's all about cutting off health care funding. And they just said it over and over and over again. It was completely false on both of them. But this is going to be one of those rare moments that you're going to pass a big bill. And the longer it sits out there, the more people are going to like it because they're going to go, oh, I didn't know that was in there. Whether you're farmers and ranchers and the farm bill is in this, the state tax changes that were done to be able to help farmers and ranchers, which you're family trying to get into a community college with Pell Grants, which that's been blocked by the Democrats for years on it, that they'll now be able to get access to Pell Grants on it, whether it is a family that will find out their taxes did not go up next year. Democrats fought tenaciously to be able to raise taxes on every American. They kept saying over and over again, this is all about millionaires and billionaires. Don't let them kid you. Every single American's taxes were going up next year. Every single rate was going up, and the Democrats were fighting tenaciously to get those rates to go up. We blocked it and said rates are not going to go up. In addition to that, we're modernizing air traffic control. We're modernizing our military. We're closing the border even more, putting long-term security there. And we're also doing no tax on tips, no tax on overtimes. Working senior adults now will not pay any additional tax on their Social Security benefits, when in the past a working senior adult had to be able to pay additional tax for that. So that's a big issue for those working senior adults. So the longer this sits out there, the more people are going to go, oh, I didn't know that was in there. That's really helpful to me and my family.
So I look at, I do know that the price of eggs and certain products, I think most products are going in the right direction. I know inflation, it went up, ticked up a little bit in percentage points, but not a lot. But if you look right now, look at a Fox News poll, and I, you know what, they tend to always skew against Republicans, but yet that's not what the science says. Only 32% say the economy is in good condition. 67% say only fair. That is currently right now. In June, it was 31%, a little bit less. In April of 2025, it was 28%. So it is going in the right direction, but still not even at 40%. So the American people, when it comes to dollars and cents, are that's the least political issue. What's it going to take for the products to be less money, the supermarket shopping to be less?
Yeah, it is access to more products. It is access to less expensive. It is getting opportunities for people to be able to see the price of energy going down, because the quantity of energy is out there, and so it brings the prices of energy down. It's going to take a little bit of time for this to be able to work through the system, but as people are already feeling, there are some things that are getting better. The challenge with inflation is always that during the Biden administration, when prices go up 21% during the Biden administration, those aren't going to go down 21%. That's now baked in, and that we're not going to have cheaper prices than what the Biden administration actually brought to us. Now it's a matter of stabilizing prices, which is what the Trump administration has done and said, okay, how can we work on critical things like eggs, energy, milk, you know, all of our basics on things. How can we work on some of those prices to be able to come down that people can feel it? And that helps everybody.
I know transportation and energy, that's what, you know, you talk about gas, oil, and diesel. If you can get that price down, the delivery is less. Got it. So I want to talk about, if I can, the decision to take a break in August. The president said, stick around. I don't have any deputy secretaries, undersecretaries. I think the judges aren't getting, after the initial surge, it looks like Democrats are just in a delay of game. So the frustration amongst your cabinet secretaries is through the roof. Nobody's working at full strength. What do you do? Why go home? Why not force the Democrats to stay?
No one here is saying, let's just drop it all. Let's go home. No one is saying that. I know that's out there in the media. I don't know a single Republican that's saying that in the Senate. Now, the House Republicans, they've already left. We still have a bit to go on trying to get nominations done. But let me tell you this, Brian, we have done twice as many nominees at this point as what we did during the first Trump administration, twice as many. And so I've had folks saying, do more. And I laugh and I go, we've been here nights, we've been here weekends. We've done twice as many nominees at this point as during the first Trump administration in the first 6 months. So we are getting a lot more done. We've done more votes in the Senate than any Senate in the past 35 years. So we are active and moving. That's how you get the one big, beautiful bill. That's how we get rescissions. That's how we get twice as many nominees. So we're after it. But there are some key positions that Democrats are trying to block. And for us, it is, we're going to get these unstuck. That's TSA, we've got to get done. That's CDC, we've got to get done. We've got to get done some of the critical folks for, like, the U.S. Marshal Service. These are all folks that are law enforcement and other critical positions that need to be done. We're going to stay until those get done. So there's no doubt on it. We're going to make sure that the critical individuals that need to be confirmed by this administration are confirmed by this administration. And either we're going to stay here all the way through August, or Democrats are going to break and allow these things to actually get done in a reasonable time period. But the target's not how many days we spend here. The target is actually getting the critical people done.
No, I hear you. But the only reason I said days is because if you tell a Democrat who are delaying these nomination votes, they're all going to get approved. They got to stay on vacation until you take the vote. That's the only way to force them to do it, right?
Yep. Yep, that's exactly right. And the flip side of this, Brian, everybody needs to pay attention. I know there's some folks eager to say, you know, the Senate is in session 11 months of the year. Go ahead and be in session the 12th month of the year. I remind folks, there are 22 of my Senate colleagues. I'm not one of them, but there are 22 of my Senate colleagues, Republicans, that they're up for election next year. We also need them home, getting a chance to be able to campaign, being among the folks in their state on it. If we want to have a Republican majority in the Senate next year, we need to also make sure some of those folks are getting face-to-face time with people back home.
Are you going to get Michael Waltz a vote? Important. What about the UN, ambassadorship? Is Michael Waltz even going to get a committee vote?
That's one of those critical ones. We've got to be able to move as fast as we can. Yes, sir.
Wow. We'll see if we can get that done. Where do you stand, and what stands out to you with the Tulsi Gabbard DNI revelations that she came forward with over the last 3 days when it comes to what was happening with the Russian investigation during the last months of the Obama administration?
Yeah, in many ways, not a surprise to me. We've seen this all along that the administration, the Obama administration, was trying to be able to find a way to be able to hurt the incoming Trump administration or find a way to be able to slow them down at the start. They knew, and they knew early on, and that evidence is out there, it has been out there, that the whole thing coming from Russia was something that was actually manufactured by the Hillary Clinton campaign in cooperation with Russia. Still, the funniest thing about the whole Russiagate piece in 2016 is the only campaign that was actually colluding with Russia was Hillary Clinton. That information is factual, that is out there, that she was working with Russian entities to be able to try to bring misinformation to be able to attack Donald Trump. So they were working with the Russians to try to affect what was actually happening in the election.
You mean the Christopher Steele
Donald
dossier?
Trump was not.
What do you mean, the Christopher Steele?
Because of the Steele dossier. Yep, the Steele dossier was something that they were working with Russians to accomplish to be able to get out.
Well, things are going good in Oklahoma. You got an NBA champion, and you have a fantastic senator. Senator James Lankford, thanks so much.
You bet.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. I'll come back and take some calls. We have a lot more to discuss, including some revelations on the Epstein story. Yes. Do I think that's getting too much attention? But and that is true. But I'm going to update you on information that I think you need to know. Don't move.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever find yourself playing the budgeting game? Well, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive, you can find options that fit your budget and potentially lower your bills. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Not available in all states.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
So I don't know, did we pull this or not? This is Arnold Schwarzenegger. He and I have something else in common. Cut 37.
And you don't even have a cell phone. You don't carry a cell phone. You
No, I have an iPad.
Yeah.
iPad, yeah.
Do you even know how to work an iPhone?
No, it's the same as a iPad. It's just small. I don't like small things.
You put the iPad up to your ear?
No. I do FaceTime.
That's right.
You know the way we always do it.
That's right.
FaceTime each other, and I FaceTime everybody.
So Allison, who likes the iPad more than me? No, maybe.
Oh, you love your iPad,
Arnold? Yeah, I'm on my iPad all the time. I have an iPad bag. So I don't even have, I'm trying to get, bring left stuff with me. So I don't even have a backpack anymore. I just have an iPad bag, and I had to go to a luggage place just to get it. I thoroughly understand. I see something else I'm eye to eye with Arnold with, because I hate the iPhone. That's part of the reason why oftentimes my texts are not eligible to be read.
Oh, that's the reason. I mean, I think these are two separate issues here.
I was so much better on the BlackBerry. I could feel the keyboard. I felt, even though it was small, I could feel the keyboard. An iPad, I prefer to do everything in an iPad.
You use your iPad like a computer, to be fair.
Right.
But I have so many things to say about your text messages being. But no, to be fair, the autocorrect is what truly has.
It kills me.
All of us. Because I used to be able to understand your typos. But now when that Siri gets involved and tries to fix it, I don't know what you want to say.
Here's the thing. Isn't in today's day and age, shouldn't your machines be getting to know you? Like now, like I told you that my Instagram can read my mind.
Yeah,
I'm wondering why the text doesn't understand what I'm trying to get at.
It's just a matter of time. Elon's going to put that chip in your brain. You're going to think it's going
to
come out.
I'm going to have to get the chip operation now.
Yes.
I can't miss a day of work.
But then all of your texts will be so readable.
Right.
And comprehensible.
Unless you lose control of the chip.
Unless your mind is really that crazy.
Unless the chip just won't take, right?
It's too crowded there already. That's the excuse. It's the chip, not the brain.
Hey, I'm Trey Gowdy, host of the Trey Gowdy Podcast. I hope you will join me every Tuesday and Thursday as we navigate life together and hopefully find ourselves a little bit better on the other side.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
And what no one seems to acknowledge is that the politics also changed. The business changed, and so did the politics. And it got way more one-sided than anything Johnny Carson was ever doing. I think we should reflect on those changes as well. It's been a big shift culturally in that regard also.
I hear you.
So he went on, Tony DiCoppo, on CBS to go against Colbert and say, in a subtle, nice way, the political bent didn't help. And he kind of defended his company of CBS, who decided 10 months later, in 10 months, you're fired. I'm going to just collapse the show. And for people to say it's all about money, you probably have a strong case to make because they were losing $40 million. So people go, I don't believe that. Well, okay, they're lying about their finances. Then you say, well, they're just trying to be cheap in order to have this merger come off with Skydance. Well, there's a problem with that. Do you know what they announced yesterday? It might have been the day before. South Park just got bought by Paramount. They worked out a five-year deal, maybe longer, cost billions of dollars, something like $2 to $5 billion that they now have South Park and their library for five more years. Does South Park politically correct ever? No, of course not. Are they ripping institutions, both parties, presidents? Yes. You think they're nice to Trump? It's Stephen Colbert. Will someone just look in the mirror and take responsibility? I mean, this is going the total other direction. Now, yesterday, he's getting angry. Listen to this. Cut 34.
One bright spot for Trump in the news right now is how much he's making my network crawl. Yesterday, Trump posted, breaking news. Yes, that is what you're doing to the news. Tell us how this time. We have just achieved a big and important win in our historic lawsuit against 60 Minutes, CBS, and Paramount. Paramount, CBS, 60 Minutes, of today, paid $16 million in settlement, and we will also anticipate receiving $20 million more from the new owners for a total of over $36 million. Wow, hold on. Plus they're paying us legal fees? 16 was 20, 36... That means by bending the knee, they lost like $40 million this year. Huh. They better watch out. They better watch out. They might get canceled. For purely financial reasons.
So, long way to go. By the way, worst impression ever. Don't do the impression if you can't do it. I mean, what is that? He just has a gravelly voice.
He's just so angry, like he can't even do impressions.
By the way, nobody confirmed that story. No one says that they paid this extra money. But here's more from Colbert. Cut 35.
The present owners are denying that additional $20 million, which I hope is true. Because could you imagine how angry people would be? Last year, Paramount laid off 2,000 employees, then cut another several hundred just last month, firing that many people, and then handing over $36 million to a guy who's putting your neighbors in alligator camps, all because of a lawsuit that your own lawyers said was completely without merit. If that's true, it would make CBS look morally bankrupt. Also bankrupt. Trump claims that additional $20 million is a gift in kind that would be paid in advertising, PSAs, or similar programming, all promoting causes supported by the president. So this fall on CBS, get ready for the new FBI Epstein redactors.
Yeah. I don't know what to say. If this goes on for 10 more months?
I mean, if this goes on like this...
They're going to just let him go.
I don't think it's going to continue for 10 months. I think they're going to be like, you know what? You're done early. Like, this is...
Right.
It's too much. It's over the line.
So, yeah. I mean, the little by little, the story's coming out. But the guy's totally obstinate and arrogant. And now he feels, and he was kidding about it, but he probably feels like the martyr. He's getting all this attention. And everyone says, well, you're number one. And they're getting rid of you because of Trump. Number one, you're number one, but your numbers are really, really low. Ridiculously low. If Conan had these numbers or Leno had these numbers, they would have been fired immediately. And late night television, in their defense, is changing dramatically. No one's tuning in, but they are too staying with Fox. And Greg's numbers are actually better than the lead in. So Greg's numbers go up. So people are finding him as an appointment television, let alone what he does on YouTube and, you know, Fox does on YouTube and everything like that. So I think that this network has done an unbelievable job meeting people where they're at. So, oh, I only watch shows on my phone. We'll see you on the phone. We only watch shows on Instagram. We see you there. That, sadly, we're doing TikTok now. I don't support that, the Chinese spying device. But we're on TikTok now and all over YouTube. Then you get this show on YouTube is fantastic. So we're meeting people where they're at because people, you know, and we're maybe making it shorter sound bites outside my live broadcast that I do in the morning, somewhere in between on Fox and Friends. So it's amazing what's happening in media and how people think they're bigger than the network. And I go back to the insurrection that NBC had when they hired Ronna McDaniel as a contributor. Yeah, Chuck Todd and others basically protest, how dare you do that? She was part of Trump's regime and tried to overthrow an election or didn't tell the truth about it. And they actually successfully fired Ronna McDaniel before she even had a chance to work, and she's now suing to get it back. It's when your employees should have a voice, but you should understand who the employer is, I thought. And it, to me, it would make sense to me. So that's where we stand. So the other big story that I'm going to be covering heavily on One Nation on Sunday, and we'll do it a lot here. We've been all over the Columbia story. And as you know, Columbia was the first to have major riots in support of Gaza, the Palestinians, and Hamas at the detriment of their Jewish students and Jewish residents of their city, whether it's out in Los Angeles in UCLA or whether it's especially in New York City, right in Harlem at Columbia. And we watched them take over the campus. We watched them take over buildings. We watched them wound at least two janitors, beat them up. They had to go to the hospital. And then we watched them take over a library 6 months ago. So the president of the United States, led by Linda McMahon, said, you know what? We're not giving you billions in grants. You're not going to get federal funding until you rein in the anti-Semitism. And they've been battling it out for about 2 years. There now is a resolve. And the resolve is $200 million, a guarantee that the Jewish students will be safe on campus, a confirmation that they'll no longer have affirmative action when it comes to their admissions policy, an identification of the different countries and contributing to your institution and where the money is going. And now they get their grant money back. And it looks like the deal is done. Here is the acting president, Claire Shipman, Cut 22.
Part of my role is to accept a lot of criticism, mm-hmm. and that is what I have been ready for and have faced in recent months. I understand that, but I actually think the narrative that paints this as a kind of binary situation, courage versus capitulation, is just wrong. It's too simplistic. This was a really, really complex problem, and I will argue over and over again that choosing to listen, choosing to try to solve the problem with everything that we had at stake is not capitulation. It was extraordinarily difficult. It took an immense amount of effort.
So David Greenwald and Jay Johnson on the Board of Trustees says today's agreement with the government affirms Columbia's unyielding commitment to academic freedom, freedom of expression, and open inquiry. There'll be an analysis on the Middle Eastern programs. They got them pro-Israel. They got some Israel history courses there, and they got some Palestinian history courses there. They're going to be monitored, not to make sure you're not raising terrorists. And look at this guy, Khalil, Mahmoud Khalil. This guy's leading activist. By the way, no masks are allowed on campus. So you can't go into the library, cover your face, can't take over a campus and an encampment and cover your face and identity. Now there's no masks. So you have a situation where Mahmoud Khalil, who was leading a lot of these insurrections, is a guy that was detained, took off campus and detained. He's a graduate student who graduated, still living on campus housing at 33 years old, who's got a kid. He's Syrian-born, of Palestinian descent, and he comes to America to protest against Israel for the BDS movement, organizing students against Israel and against the Columbia faculty. So they detain him to deport him, and a judge allowed him to be released. And then yesterday, we played you the exchange. He would not even admit that Hamas is a terrorist group or condemn their actions on October 7th, would only say we're against the killing of civilians. But the real cause now are the conditions in Gaza. That means he lied on his student visa application and his green card application. So his loyalty is not to this country. And anybody in Democrat taking pictures with this guy after he refuses to condemn Hamas, I have to assume would also refuse to condemn Hamas. Like the entire squad in Bernie Sanders. Look at the pictures. They are available online. Next is Harvard. Harvard had their case heard on Monday. We're waiting for the judge to rule if the federal government simply can withhold grant money because they are not living up to their terms of accreditation and not made things hostile for the different ethnic groups, specifically for the Jewish students. And there's other things they're being challenged on. So Harvard decides to fight. They're spending millions of dollars to do it. And the federal government is more than happy to go through with it. They can do that. That's what these guys do. So they are on campus, and I expect this Obama-appointed judge to rule with Harvard. Is going to go right up the ladder to appeal. And sooner or later, Harvard is going to lose. And they're going to sit there and say, we've lost billions of dollars. They'd be much smarter to come in and say, we're going to make these reforms. We're going to pay this amount of money, and we'll get our grants back. I would like to know, too, if this grant money's been effective at all, have you come up with anything? Have you cured cancer? You helped out with that athlete's foot? Anything have you made progress on? I would love to know. Linda McMahon is going to be on with me on Saturday. But one of the people who weighed in, who's outraged by this deal, is Claire McCaskill. She's on, of course, MSNBC, Cut 27.
If you back this up and you look at it broadly, there are really two things in the United States that were so strong in terms of our standing around the world. One was the rule of law, and the other was higher education. And Trump administration is doing permanent, lasting damage to both.
You know, it's amazing. There might have been a reputation around the world for our institutions and a desire to come here because of the country. But higher education is known as a left-wing bastion, and now a radical left-wing bastion, not only liberal over conservative, how about anti-American over pro-American? And Claire McCaskill's proud of that? Cut 28.
And on higher education, Mike, it's not just the research money that's going away and the impact on millions of lives in terms of cures and breakthroughs in medicine and other types of science. It's also foreign students. They are on a path, the Trump administration, to try to make sure there are no foreign students in higher education in the United States of America.
Less, not none. Less. I don't know why. I mean, I think these are great institutions. You want to have foreign influence in there. You want to be able to have a kid from different countries, whether it's Finland or Somalia, whatever. But I don't think 27% of a student body should be from another country. And it's an American university. And a lot of them, Ivy League institutions, got these great reputations. I think there's a lot of valedictorians not getting into these schools. So some ungrateful Syrian Palestinian can go and show up at 28 years old and be a freshman. So we're done with that. Go ahead. Go to bat for foreign students over American students, Claire McCaskill and the Democratic Party. I think that's a fantastic debate for Donald Trump. When we come back, we'll finish up with some calls, 1-866-408-7669. And just a quick reminder for everyone at KLIF and everyone surrounding in Dallas, I'm going to be there on the 23rd of August. History, Liberty, and Laughs streamed on Fox Nation. Don't move.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
I'm Janice Dean. Join me every Sunday as I focus on stories of hope and people who are truly rays of sunshine in their community and across the world.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com.
fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Just got a few minutes here. We can always go to the phone calls, but I also want to go over what's going on. The best I can talk about what Tulsi Gabbard is now bringing to the table with these revelations. I know some people are saying this reminds me of 2016, and I get it. It does remind me of 2016, but here's what's different. According to the new, and don't hit me with Senator Rubio, when he was head of the Intelligence Committee, signed off on an investigation that said the Russians meddled with our election and that Donald Trump had nothing to do with it. I got it. But that has nothing to do with the intelligence that Tulsi Gabbard has as director of national intelligence. Senate and the DNI don't see the same things. Just think about it. And what he saw in 2018 is not what she's seeing in 2025, because whistleblowers have come up to us and said, we watched an orchestrated event, I'm paraphrasing, of how they went behind the scenes to first establish wrongly that Vladimir Putin wanted Donald Trump to win. There's no proof of that. He wanted to damage Hillary Clinton because he thought Hillary Clinton was going to win. We saw that they were planting some stories out there. They did not affect any voting machines. They just had Facebook ads. So you can't say they affected the election. It should have been something brought up and done. But instead, on December 6th, it turns out that Ted Cruz learned that they changed everything. They decided to change the perception out there from Donald Trump had nothing to do with colluding and that they didn't affect the election, the Russians, to Donald Trump investigated for colluding with Vladimir Putin to beat Hillary Clinton. Listen to Senator Ted Cruz. He spells it out very effectively. Cut eight.
December 8th, Obama's presidential daily briefing. Here's what it said. Quote, we assess that Russian and criminal actors did not impact recent U.S. election results by conducting malicious cyber activities against election infrastructure. So all the way up to December 8th, over and over and over again, they say, no Russia, no Russia, no Russia. And then December 9th, there's a meeting with DNI Director Clapper, with National Security Advisor Susan Rice, with Secretary of State John Kerry, and with Deputy FBI Director McCabe, in which they reverse their positions altogether, and they all come out to say, Russia, 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 that's why Trump got elected. And I'll tell you, this December 9th meeting, FDR famously said December 7th is a date that will live in infamy. Well, December 9th should be a day that will live in infamy, because this is a moment when senior members of our government decided to lie to the American people and to sabotage President Donald Trump, who'd just been elected by the American people.
And guess who was there? President Obama orchestrating it. In fact, James Clapper later on, not knowing it, to Anderson Cooper, said that Barack Obama was the one who got us together and said, you know, we have to look into this. When James Clapper thought he was doing God's work to establish, and I don't think for real, to establish that Donald Trump was working with Vladimir Putin, that's the only way he pulled off the biggest upset in American political history. And along the way, George Papadopoulos goes to jail. Carter Page's life gets ruined. Paul Manafort goes to jail in solitary confinement. He can't get an early job since then. Did get pardoned by President Trump. Michael Flynn's career gets ruined. He gets exiled for 3 years. Can't get a job. Can't get work. And got let go from the Trump administration. And Senator Sessions recuses himself as attorney general because of stuff he did as a senator. Called meeting with the ambassador from Russia. And then Trump is so angry at him that he stepped aside and hired a special counsel. He fires him right after the midterms. So think about how our country was hurt. So it is worth going back. But with Tulsi Gabbard, just focus on the new, because there were countless books written about it. But also thought, and I'll play this at a different hour today, talked about how some reporters, even in that room yesterday, still have no interest in this story, no interest in finding out if the former president tried to destroy an administration that followed him because he's from a different party. But also, the same reporters are still in the Washington establishment, many of which won awards for their investigating on the Russian collusion story, which they got totally wrong, but they kept their Pulitzer prizes. It's crazy. Brian Kilmeade Show.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show at 48th and 6th over in Midtown Manhattan, where the whole world's watching because of this mayor's race. Governor Cuomo is trying to tell everybody he's not too tired and can actually win this thing. I don't think so. Curtis Sliwa, really strong in studio on Monday, knows the issues. I will tell you he's extremely confident. And Eric Adams says, I'm just getting started. We had to interview him on One Nation Sunday night at 10 o'clock. Standing by is Mark Thiessen, The Washington Post. Bottom of the hour, Brett Baer. He's got a lot to discuss with us, including his big interview last night with the CEO of NVIDIA, and prior to that, the foreign minister of Iran. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
The narrative that paints this as a kind of binary situation, courage versus capitulation, is just wrong. It's too simplistic. This was a really, really complex problem.
Claire Shipman, who's temporarily running Columbia, and they cut a big deal, the first of many with higher education, as President Trump looks to clamp down on the biasness on campus and the anti-Semitism that is raging. We'll bring you the details of this first deal.
Number two.
Mostly we'll be charging straight tariffs to most of the rest of the world. That's a lot of deals. Even if you're like me, a deal junkie, that's a lot of deals.
Yep, economic rocket ship. A week after a massive crypto investment comes a focus on AI with billions of dollars pledged and already in action. I was talking to the head of Meta about an hour ago, putting billions into Louisiana, and a record trade deal now with Japan. Trump is on an economic roll, but polls say America is not feeling it yet. What will it take?
Number one.
I'm leaving the criminal charges to the Department of Justice. I'm not an attorney, but as I've said previously, the expressed intent and what followed afterward can only be described as a years-long coup and a treasonous conspiracy.
DNI Director Gabbard, Tulsi, takes aim at Obama and his left-wing intel surrogates, while Dems suddenly find an interest in Epstein. And we have movement on both stories, which seems to have all of the media's attention, but really doesn't affect any of your lives. Mark Thiessen joins us now. We read your column this morning, Mark, about the so-called isolationists against Donald Trump. I know they want to be called restrainers, and I want to get into that, but your thoughts about what the DNI director presented so far?
So first of all, there's a question. There's a lot to unpack here, right? So did Russia interfere in the 2016 election? Yes, absolutely they did. And that's why Donald Trump launched a cyber attack on the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg, the troll farm that interfered in the election, to take it out. So, you know, this is, you know, unlike Obama, who let the Russians meddle in the election without any consequences whatsoever, Donald Trump blew up the Trump farm with a cyber attack. So let's remember that. The sub question is, were they trying to help elect Donald Trump? And was there a conspiracy between Trump and Russia to steal the election? And the answer to the last question is absolutely not. It's been proven by the Mueller report that was nothing more than a conspiracy theory. And we spent, because of this effort, we spent by the Obama administration and the Democratic left, we spent 2 years and tens of millions of dollars chasing a conspiracy theory that hamstrung the president's first term. It was an attempted coup. It was disgraceful. And it should have never happened. And the most, you know, I understand Democrats making this charge against Trump. I understand even people in the media who were rallying against him. Those things were, you know, it's not right, but it's almost understandable. They hated Trump so much. What is unacceptable are the people in the intelligence community who pushed this lie, because the people like Brennan and Adam Schiff and Swalwell, who were on the intelligence committees in Congress, what they were basically telling Americans was, we've seen secret evidence that you can't see that Donald Trump colluded with Russia. and that the election was stolen and that his presidency is illegitimate. And it turned out to be a complete lie, but they spread it. And so they destroyed confidence in the intelligence community, confidence in the, you know, most of the people in the intelligence community are not partisan hacks. They're actually trying to protect us. And this layer of political hacks that was running it, who said that Donald Trump was an agent of Russia, had committed treason. You know, the people are getting upset that Tulsi Gabbard is saying that this was a treasonous conspiracy. John Brennan went on television and accused Donald Trump of treason. He used that exact word. He was pressed by Chuck Todd, and he said, you mean treason? And he said, yeah, I mean aiding and abetting the enemy. That's exactly what I mean. I stand by it. So, you know, spare me your crocodile tears.
So here is Tulsi Gabbard talking about what she's found out. Cut four.
So shortly after coming into this position of as Director of National Intelligence, I formed a special team to investigate this issue. I got to tell you, it wasn't easy. There were a lot of deep state obstacles that exist still within the intelligence community. But ultimately, we had a whistleblower who came forward that brought some critical pieces to this story. And we were able to discover these documents and find these documents that really pointed to President Obama directing his national security leaders in James Clapper and John Brennan to manufacture this January 2017 intelligence community assessment.
So that was the whole thing. And I think Ted Cruz said it best. I'm not going to play the whole clip, but he points to one day, cut eight.
December 8th, Obama's presidential daily briefing. Here's what it said, quote, "We assess that Russian and criminal actors did not impact recent U.S. election results by conducting malicious cyber activities against election infrastructure." So all the way up to December 8th, over and over and over again, they say, no Russia, no Russia, no Russia. And then December 9th, there's a meeting with DNI Director Clapper, with National Security Advisor Susan Rice, with Secretary of State John Kerry, and with Deputy FBI Director McCabe, in which they reverse their positions altogether, and they all come out to say, Russia, 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 that's why Trump got elected.
Understood. He said, if you look at the memos and the paperwork that was released, you pick that day, and Obama decides to make it offensive, and we know what happened. George Papadopoulos, Carter Page, Paul Manafort, Michael Flynn, just some of the people that their lives and careers got ruined, and some went to jail over something they didn't do, let alone that you had Jared Kushner. He was ready. In his book, he said he thought he was going to jail over taking calls from Russia prior to getting his job that he did for free for President Trump, which every incoming administration was doing. That's how crazy this got.
So here's I can't judge the evidence yet about this, but I can tell you, but it's one, it's absolutely clear that Russia did not influence the outcome of the election.
True.
Either through cyber means or through interference. And two, to the question of whether Putin wanted Trump to get elected, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. If he did want Trump to get elected, boy, was that a big mistake, because Donald Trump was and is tougher on Russia than any president since Ronald Reagan. Again, he launched the cyber attack on the Internet Research Agency. He got NATO to spend, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars more on its national security. He authorized the U.S. military to kill hundreds of Wagner fighters in eastern Syria. He imposed crippling sanctions on Moscow during his presidency. I could go on the
armed
list
Ukraine.
On and on of the things that he did. He armed Ukraine. You know, if everyone's surprised that Trump is arming Ukraine right now, he was when Obama was giving him blankets, he was giving him javelins. And so, you know, you can go through the litany. I think there was no president who was tougher on Russia than Donald Trump. And, you know, and so the idea that this is, if Putin really wanted him to get elected, that is a sign of that Putin is not a very savvy political operator.
All right. Real quick. I know you're not an economics guy, but you understand deals. The Japan deal is in, the Vietnam deal is in, the Indonesia deal is in, the UK deal is in. The Japan deal, they say, is the biggest in history. The EU is on deck. How is this playing out? Compare this to April, the freak out in April, to what we're experiencing in July. Just look at the market.
Yeah, so the question was, with Trump, is he using the tariffs to get deals to reduce barriers to U.S. exports, or does he want tariffs? And the answer is yes. right? He wants both. And so he wants a we're seeing a new thing coming out where he's using tariffs as leverage to open up markets for U.S. goods, but he's settling not for zero for zero deals, which is sort of the standard in past trade deals to eliminate tariffs, to, you know, something like 10 or 15% tariff as a baseline tariff. Now, that's higher than it's been historically. And it's not something that's going to stop people from you know, it's not going to build a protectionist wall that forces us to reshore jobs here and reshore industries. But it's going to bring in more revenue. And if you think about this, when Ronald Reagan was president, the principle of the Reagan Revolution was the Laffer Curve, right? Which is that the idea of the Laffer Curve was that if you have a zero tax rate, you get zero revenue. If you have 100% tax rate, you get zero revenue because nobody produces anything. And somewhere there's a curve where somewhere there's an optimal tax rate where you get the most revenue without crushing productivity, right? That a tariff is a tax. So the same thing applies to tariffs. A zero tariff rate means zero revenue. 100% tariff rate means zero revenue too, because nobody's going to trade with you. Somewhere low on that curve is an optimal tariff rate where you're bringing in revenue, but you're not reducing trade. And maybe that's 10%. Maybe that's 15%. I don't know. But Trump is applying this principle of Reaganomics to the trade to trade, and it makes sense.
And by the way, the tariff money helps because nobody retaliated outside, I think, Canada, of all people. Nobody retaliated. They basically are paying it. So we've gotten an extra $100 billion+ since April, Liberation Day. So you just talked about today within the Republican Party in your column, there's two groups that are forming. There's an isolationist group who do not want to be involved in Ukraine, do not want to be involved with Iran. Not our problem. You know, Russia's not the issue. You know, who knows how they feel about Taiwan, but that group helped Trump get elected. How's he responded since he got the job?
So I don't know that they helped Trump get elected, and I don't know that they that
well, they voted
that,
for him.
They voted for him, but they're tiny. They're loud and small. They have no constituency in the American public. You look at the Reagan Institute poll and, you know, 90% support bombing Iran, 70% support, being more engaged in the world. Only a small fraction say less. The MAGA movement is not isolationist. And the neo-isolationist right knows that people don't like isolationism. So they don't want to call themselves isolationists. So they've decided to call themselves restrainers. Well, who exactly are they trying to restrain?
Trump. I don't know. Yeah.
Trump. They're trying to restrain Trump. They didn't want him to bomb the Houthis, right? That's Europe's problem. Well, he bombed the hell out of the Houthis, and he took out thousands of Houthi targets and protected our shipping around the world. They didn't want him to bomb Iran. They, you know, Tulsi Gabbard, put up a video saying, you know, the warmongers want to get us into a new nuclear war. And she had to be dressed down publicly by the president. He went out and he crushed obliterated the Iranian nuclear program. They didn't want him to arm Ukraine. It's not our problem, not our war. Trump is arming Ukraine. The restrainers are trying to restrain Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is not restrainable. He has never been an isolationist. You look at his first term record. This is a guy who bombed Syria twice for using chemical weapons on its people. Killed Qasem Soleimani, destroyed the ISIS caliphate. That no president in my lifetime has exercised U.S. military strength, flexed America's military muscle on the world stage more effectively without getting us drawn into long ground combat than Donald Trump. And so he's not an isolationist, and the isolationists are sort of on the outside. They're out of step with Trump, and they're out of step with the MAGA movement. And I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to hijack MAGA and turn it into an isolationist foreign policy vehicle for their Fortress America views. And Trump's not playing along. And, you know, the big question is what happens after Trump, which is a question for, you know, a few years from now.
Well, you got a couple of million dollars raised over the weekend, 2.4, and J.D. Vance over in Narragansett, he's already got a lot of money. I guess he wants to establish himself as the front runner, but it's going to be fascinating because I think President Trump, from what I know of him, is not going to like if these guys start campaigning while he's in office.
I think that's true. And also, you know, so two things. One, I think there's going to be a huge field. I think there's going to be a lot of people running for president for the Republican Party in the first truly open primary we've had in a very long time. And two, you know, J.D. Vance is associated with the restrainer camp. His philosophy was very isolationist in the Senate. But, you know, he's the apprentice right now, to coin a phrase, right? He's watching Trump. He's seeing how Trump is using U.S. military support. Maybe he's going to learn something. Maybe he's going to be different when he runs in 3.5 years. Maybe he'll have a different view. I don't think that he would have bombed Iran. I don't think he would have bombed the Houthis. But he saw Trump do it and saw how effective it was and saw that it didn't get us drawn into new wars. So maybe he'll learn something. And that would be good for the country.
And he's also talking to world leaders and seeing their response and seeing whose response he respects and doesn't. And then how does this benefit us? Instead of being an isolationist doesn't work. Fascinating, because at the same time, the president's talking about cryptocurrency, setting up regulations to have it take off responsibly, and then yesterday with AI. So he's taken the West Coast, Silicon Valley, who was beginning to become anti-American, and they were not even cooperating in many cases with our defense industry, and now they're all on board with Republicans. Final thought on that?
So, I mean, I love companies like Palantir and Alex Karp. Alex Karp says that he founded Palantir to defend Western civilization. That's the kind of patriotism we need to see out of Silicon Valley, and we're seeing more of it.
And Joe Lonsdale, thanks so much. Appreciate it, Mark Thiessen. Great job.
Take care.
You got it. We'll come back. We'll squeeze in some calls and get your feedback. Brett Baer at the bottom of the hour. Don't move.
Increasing your intelligence quotient.
What the hell did you just say?
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. Now, I was looking for fun ways to tell you that Mint's offer of unlimited premium wireless for $15 a month is back. So I thought it would be fun if we made $15 bills. But it turns out that's very illegal. So there goes my big idea for the commercial. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speed slow after 35 gigabytes if network's busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
He has not been subpoenaed. He came in voluntarily, so he can't plead the fifth. And, you know, all the arrows point towards him as being one of the main players, if not the main player, in the Audepin scandal. He's one of the last men standing in this, and I think he'll answer questions.
I don't know. Well, I don't know why you think he would. I hope he does. And he's talking about Ron Klain, and that is James Comer, the Oversight Committee chair. And they're just trying to find out what Joe Biden was doing and not doing. And also, ultimately, to maybe invalidate some of these pardons and commutations. I mean, some of the people, do you look at some of the police blotters and the back of these guys' crime cards? There's no way they should be out of prison. Who did that? Who lined it up? Who controlled the auto pen? And was it really on President Biden's watch? I mean, was it really on his behest? Did he really sign off on this? He went from I signed off on all of them to I gave the criteria and it was up for them to execute it because you couldn't possibly sign it. And then it turns out he didn't sign anything really except Hunter's. And then there's more confusion, and they've expanded the investigation since Hunter Biden came out and said my dad was on Ambien. They gave him Ambien, and then he said they could have given him Ambien. I don't know for sure. So that created a problem, a prescription drug you're not telling us about. Ron Klain had an excerpt in Craig Shirley's book about the administration that said leading up to the debate where he came back and helped out, Biden was exhausted. He left the last session and just said, I'm really tired. I need to go take a nap. Who gave him an Ambien? Ambien's supposed to make you tired, make you sleepy. I don't know. Beats me. Crazy stuff. Let's see if anybody speaks. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back. Brett Baer is going to be with us in a matter of moments. Keep in mind, he's got a book coming out. It's called Rescue the American Spirit, Teddy Roosevelt and the Birth of a Superpower. But we are talking about a bunch of things, including this Russia hoax investigation and what new Tulsi Gabbard is bringing to the table. And essentially, she's saying barely a mention that Vladimir Putin wanted Trump to win. They made it seem as if they almost, and then they went from they affected the election to they didn't affect the election to he combined with Donald Trump to possibly collude to win an election. And the investigation lasted 2.5 years. Tulsi Gabbard's finding different things as she put a task force together as director of national intelligence to find out what really took place after and leading up to the election. Here's what she pointed out is the role that she's finding that former President Obama played. Cut three.
Do you believe that any of this new information implicates former President Obama in criminal behavior?
We have referred and will continue to refer all of these documents to the Department of Justice and the FBI to investigate the criminal implications of this.
For even former President
evidence,
Obama?
Correct. The evidence that we have found and that we have released directly point to President Obama leading the manufacturing of this intelligence assessment. There are multiple pieces of evidence and intelligence that confirm that fact.
And they point to even a certain day, I think it's December 9th, where everything went from let's find out information to let's see if we can direct this against Trump. That's the accusation. Brett Baer joins us now. Brett, your thought about where this investigation is going and what new have you learned?
Listen, Brian, I think that the documents show a pattern. And we haven't really seen the end of it. I think the president said there's hundreds more, maybe 1,000. And you heard that from Tulsi Gabbard as well. I think that what becomes painting the picture, and we had a suspicion that, you know, they were really trying hard to tag Russia to the Trump administration, to the president-elect. I mean, remember the coverage back then of, you know, he was a Russian asset, essentially. And nothing that we've seen backs up any of those early conclusions. And then, you know, yesterday we went back and I played the 2018 interview with Jim Comey. I kind of grilled him on specifics of the investigation and the disparity between the Hillary Clinton email investigation and the Trump Russia investigation is really stark. And I think people have to look back at the prism of that time to get a context of what this all starts to look like.
Yeah, and part of the reason is, look, so people to know, the dossier that was looked as pure fiction was also used by John Brennan to build a case and to get FISA warrants to pursue different surrogates representing Trump, not major players outside of, you know, you had Carter Page and you had George Papadopoulos. But when asked about the origins of the dossier, which is so controversial, it was amazing how ambivalent he was. Cut nine.
When the Steele dossier comes out sometime early July, when did you personally learn about the memos in the dossier?
Sometime in the fall. I don't remember exactly when.
So who told you about them?
I don't remember. Someone on my senior staff.
Do you remember how they were described?
I remember they briefed me about it, explained that it came from a reliable source, former Allied intelligence officer.
When did you learn that the DNC and Hillary Clinton campaign had funded Christopher Steele's work?
Yeah, I still don't know that for a fact.
What do you mean?
I've only seen it in the media. I never knew exactly which Democrats had funded. I knew it was funded first by Republicans, opposed to Donald.
But that's not true.
I'm sorry?
That's not true. That the dossier that Christopher Steele worked on was funded by Republicans?
Yeah, my understanding was his work started funded by Oppo Research, funded by Republicans.
So Free Beacon and said that they had Glenn Simpson and Fusion GPS on a kind of a retainer, but they did not fund the Christopher Steele memo or the dossier. That was initiated by Democrats.
Okay, my understanding was the activity was begun, that Steele was hired to look into, was first funded by Republicans, then picked up, the important thing was, picked up by Democrats opposed to Donald Trump.
Did you tell President Obama that the dossier was ever, who it was funded by?
No, not to my recollection.
Do you want to know who it was funded by?
I wanted to know what I knew, which is it was funded by people politically opposed to Donald Trump.
So you still to this day don't know that it was funded by the DNC or
I've read
the
that in the
campaign?
Media, but I don't know for a fact and didn't know while I was at the FBI.
I mean, you're the FBI director. You don't want to know the origins of intelligence about the future and current president of the United States? Even at I could see you were totally in disbelief.
That you're briefing on, that you are talking to National Intelligence Director, the CIA Director, that is a big part of the FISA application to spy on Carter Page. I mean, listen, you have to have a whiteboard to remember all the specifics of this thing. We are so inundated in it that I remembered, I knew kind of every piece of it, definitely back then. I still have it in my mind. But you have to remember how all of this is interconnected. And here is a FBI director saying, I didn't know who funded it. I still don't know the Democrats officially funded it. I read it in the media.
Yeah, I mean, and I just don't believe that for a second, but that whole feeling of who are you, that arrogant way, which kind of question is that? But I'll answer it for you people. If it could sell a few books or help you tell your story, which was the story, and it's basically John Brennan, James Comey, President Obama, Susan Rice together have what they are claiming was legitimate questions about how Donald Trump was elected. And looking back at this paperwork, they don't have legitimate questions. They know how he was elected. The Russians didn't affect it, but they went out of their way to make it seem like that. And when they got Robert Mueller to be special prosecutor, they must have been high-fiving wherever they were located, maybe in the Barack Obama's mansion.
Yeah, because Mueller was starting to be off his game, and then the testimony of Mueller, really, he was off his game, and you realized how there wasn't any there. You know, it just was not there. And now I think, you know, they classified a lot of documents. So thinking that nobody was going to get to them, well, Tulsi Gabbard is getting to them and declassifying them. And listen, it's a story. Is it the biggest story? I don't know. Maybe, because maybe it goes to even more documents that point directly to it. But it's clearly a big story, and it's kind of surprising that it doesn't get covered on substance in other places.
But it's like it was never covered. It wasn't covered. It was only covered that on the collusion element of it, but not after the Robert Mueller found out there was no collusion element of it. People just got their trophies, their awards for covering a story that wasn't true. And then they just went back to not being curious about it when it turned out not to be true.
It's really amazing. If you think back at that time, you know, how many TV shows on other networks are going, tick, 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 here comes the thing that's coming the next day, breaking, you know, Washington Post, New York Times. And it was every day. It was like another drip, drip, drip from the intelligence community. And now, you know, there's no interest. And it's really unbelievable.
So what's happening again, though, we're watching in real time. The Epstein becomes an investigation that almost every other channel and every Democrat wants to cover. They have had no interest on it for 10 years, almost none, except, you know, with Bill Gates, when Bill Gates' name came up, when Prince Andrew's name came up, when Bill Clinton's picture popped up. Then people were curious about Epstein. Did he kill himself? But now that they feel as though there's links to Trump, this is what Democrats want to focus on. And now you have Republicans in the House saying, okay, we do want all this information and we do want an investigation. And it turns out in the Wall Street Journal today, Pam Bondi came out and told Trump in May that his name popped up in the Epstein files. She said it was coming multiple times, but she did also say it doesn't involve wrongdoing. Your name's there, which shouldn't surprise Trump because he knew him and he came to his wedding.
Yeah, our David Sprunt confirmed that as well, that briefing had happened, she had said, just because your name's in here doesn't mean it's anything bad. She said that, you know, it's not, we don't see it at this point. And so David Spun had that as well yesterday. I think, you know, listen, in the big context, we don't know what's in these documents and these files, all of them. And is there a push to get them all out? Yes. Do people believe, considering how the Russia hoax, as it's called by the Trump administration,
was handled back in the day. Do people really believe if there was super bad material that involved Donald Trump that it wouldn't have managed to leak from the intelligence community during the Biden years? I mean, I'm not sure I can get there.
I can't get there either. And I would say these are my two analogies. And I would not be surprised if this turned up on Special Report tonight, maybe in your monologue. And no one, you know, I'm not going to say anything. But it's there's a lot. And if it happens, it happens. I'm used to it. But there's a lot of people who said Bill Cosby was a national treasure and was the best comedian maybe ever. And there's tons of pictures with Bill Cosby. Well, it turns out there was another life. There's a lot of people when I was out in California that just – O.J. Simpson was a top broadcaster, was a top athlete, was a movie star for a while. Everybody was hanging out with him. Al Michaels was his best friend, and so was Bob Costas, was tight. And then he ends up being a double murderer. So obviously, I don't blame these people for hanging out with him when their character turns out to be different. 15 years before Epstein hung himself, Trump said, "I'm done with this guy. He's a creep."
Him out of the club in 2004. I think that transparency is the greatest thing. I'm all for, you know, lighting up the dark places. And we may get to a point where that's exactly what happens. But this whole thing about, you know, every little nuance is another breaking story. It does feel like a pattern, and we'll see. We'll see where it goes.
All right. Brett, last night's interview with the NVIDIA CEO, the founder, his story is unbelievable. But I just thought it was interesting. His point to President Trump to allow him to sell the best chips in the world to China, or the second best. H-20 is the second best. H-100 is the best. And he said, look, if we base – and tell me if I'm wrong here – if we don't sell them to them, they're going to find a way to make their own. And then they're going to be totally on their own. At least we would be leading the field and be in control of the currency for this new technology. And exactly. Trump bought into it, right?
He did. And, you know, he was convinced that these are very complex to make. NVIDIA has, you know, this process, and the really high stuff, that cutting edge stuff, is not the stuff that would be going to China. It would be the lower iteration. That said, I asked Jensen Huang, you know, who's to say that in 3 months your chip becomes a China chip? And he said, we have to engage. America has to be leading, and we'll control the innovation side, which I think is a message that they've got, you know, safeguards, and that the best stuff will be in the U.S.
We got a raging stock market. We got another trade deal, and I think the EU seems to be ready to launch. And the president's got the big, beautiful bill, now a law that he feels as though the more people know it, the better it's going to be. You got the attack on our successful attack on Iran's nuclear program. How frustrated do your sources say the president is that people aren't focusing on that and are focusing on the Epstein scandal?
Yeah, he's a little PO'd, I think, from people who are in the circle. He understands it's part of the game. That said, he looks at the chessboard and sees a lot of great moves for the U.S. And to your point, you know, markets, the fact that money is coming in from all over the world, not just the tariff money, but investment and opening markets other places. The Japan deal, very proud of, and I think there's going to be an EU deal very soon. They're on the cusp of it. You know, you got the possibility of real skyrocketing growth. And it's, you know, a lot of people are looking at on the market side in pretty bullish terms.
Right. And by the way, the latest on Hamas and the hostage release, it looks like Hamas is not quite there yet. And they disbanded talks. Everyone back to their respective corners with Hamas. We thought we might have a hostage deal coming down, but it looks like it's going to be delayed. But the talks are not dead. We'll see what happens over here.
I just did a taping with some of the families of hostages still alive, and also one that has been released, talking about what it's like on the inside. We're going to
air that next week, but I talked to them for a long, long time, and you know, you just, the grief of waiting is overwhelming.
Absolutely, Brett. Big interviews. I just want you, the foreign minister of Iran, the takeaway. I love the follow-up when you basically said you're funding Hezbollah and Hamas. These are terrorist groups. He goes, no, they're freedom fighters, but we have to help them. You have to help Hezbollah take over Lebanon? Really?
Yeah. I thought some of those answers were really jarring, but I think the viewers knew what he was doing. I did think there were some things that came out of that, you know, his assessment of the damage, severely damaged or destroyed nuclear facilities, but then saying we are going to do enrichment and continue enrichment because it's a national pride. That caught some people in the White House by surprise because they thought Iran was going to come to the table differently.
I hear you. Brett Baer, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
We'll see you.
Yep. Brett Baer, back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
This is Jason Chaffetz from the Jason in the House podcast. Join me every Monday to dive deeper into the latest political headlines and chat with remarkable guests.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com
or wherever you download podcasts.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we are back. 1-866-408-7669. Let's go out to Sandra in New Jersey. Hey, Sandra.
Good morning, Brian. Brian?
What's on your mind?
Oh, what's on my mind is this morning I heard Jack Ceccarelli speak, and he said that Mickey Sherrill is endorsing Mamdani. Look, that man makes me quiver.
Jack Ceccarelli is the Republican nominee, and I think
that's
it's Mikey,
right.
Isn't it? Yeah, it's Mikey Sherrill.
Mikey Sherrill.
Yeah.
And if she becomes our governor, my body's going to quiver even more. Jack Ceccarelli is the real deal. If you listen to him over and over, you'll see how much he knows about the state of New Jersey. And he's not even governor yet. I'm very concerned that this woman has such poor judgment to endorse Mamdani. I'm very concerned. I really am.
Well, you know what? Brian. Hakeem Jeffries hasn't. Schumer hasn't. Would you say? Yeah, I'm not sure if there was an endorsement. We're looking that up now, Sandra. We'll see. James in Florida. Hey, James.
How's it going, Brian?
What's on your mind?
Should Tulsi Gilbert request a military tribunal over a civilian trial concerning Obama was in charge of the military? And I'll hang up and listen to your response.
I don't think that you're going to actually charge Obama. I think the goal with President Obama, especially in light of the Supreme Court decision saying a president making decisions as president cannot be indicted or convicted or tried, I do think the message is we knew what you were up to. Make sure people are exposed what they were up to, how the deep state really went out of their way to destroy Donald Trump and were unsuccessful, and how much better he would have been had they not trumped up that investigation. But I think that Brennan and Comey and others are the ones in the crosshairs. And maybe Susan Rice. Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Will Kane Country. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday at foxnews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss the show. Listen and follow the podcast 5 days a week at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. This hour, we're going to be joined by Senator Majority Leader John Thune. Love the loyalty he has to the program. It's truly fantastic because he's got a lot on his mind. He's got a lot to say, and he's got a lot of control, and he's got a lot of success. You know, I don't know how well President Trump knew Senator Thune before he got the job as Majority Leader, but he knew he didn't like Mitch McConnell. He knew that for sure. But they have really hit it off. Gillian Turner is going to be here in a matter of moments. Some reports are she's here already. She's with Fox News, and she hosts all over the channel. But what are you doing today, Gillian? What's your job today?
I just anchored America's Newsroom with
for 2 hours.
Mr. Bill Hemmer.
How do you deal with Hemmer? He's a handful.
I'm not supposed to say anything.
Right. You know, just between us.
Yeah, just between us. It's difficult.
It's not easy.
He's pretty high maintenance.
Right. He is known as the easiest anchor in the world to work with. That's
honestly,
why I said that.
He literally, you could be a potato sitting in the chair and he would make you look great.
Oh, he does a good job. But you do not need any help. And you're basically all over
Thanks
the
for lying
today.
To me. I appreciate it.
That is not true. You're also on the five, correct?
No, not on the five. Not on the five this week.
But you have been in the past.
I've been on the five.
And you have managed to...
I'm almost recovered from it, too.
I think your style throws off Gutfeld. He doesn't know quite what to make you. He doesn't know you have a sense of humor.
He's jealous of me.
You think so?
That's my personal... Again, just between us, that's my personal take on it.
Right. In what way? Like, what are you doing that he wants to
do? Well, like, for example, last time I was on the five, he made fun of me because I was wearing an orange blazer.
Right.
I'm like, you wish you could wear orange. wish.
And the fact that you can take it and give it back, that makes you endearing to him.
A long time, like from back, like before, like when I was a contributor on Fox.
Red Eye?
No, it was like after Red Eye, but it was when he had his weekend show.
Oh, so he was much more humble.
Going back to then. Yeah, it was like before he got this, like, you know, holier than thou thing going on.
Right. But he did get funnier.
I don't know. I don't know.
He's kind of over.
He got better ratings.
Right. So you just
think. I'll give him that.
Overall, what I'm getting from you is overrated. Gutfeld a little overrated.
I didn't say it. You said it, but, you know.
That's how you feel.
I'm not going to confirm or deny.
Fantastic. Have you noticed this? We are focusing on three big scandals. Epstein, Tulsi Gabbard, and we're focusing on, what's the other third one? We got Tulsi Gabbard,
Biden decline,
Epstein.
Or that's kind of.
What did you say?
Biden decline. Do you count
yes,
that as the other
I
one?
Do.
Yeah.
Because we have three things. And what's happening today with Ron Klain, the former chief
right,
of staff,
yeah.
comes in. But do you realize, it, for the American people, outside people who like soap operas and reality shows, it's really of no consequence. I mean, the things that really matter is what's going on. Is Iran going to sign into this deal? What's going to be the turmoil in the Middle East? In terms of these trade deals, that's going to affect the American people. If you see the scope of the trade that could be coming to our shores, that AI meeting yesterday.
Yeah, big deal.
Do you know anybody? There's nobody that could say AI has nothing to do with me. It is really like the emergence of the internet.
I mean, you know, you could make a really sound argument that all that matters for the future is whether the U.S. or China wins the AI race. Whoever dominates there, that's it. That's the future of humanity.
And
not
that was,
just
and that
this
was
country or that country, but like this is the most important fight that the United States is fighting.
So if you have that, the cryptocurrency, the big, beautiful law, love it or hate it, these are the things that are consequences. Why? You talk about unemployment. You talk about opportunity. You're talking about the price of goods that you shop with every day in order to allow you to pay for your kids' camp or to be able to get that new car or that new house. So why do you think the first four stories in the New York Times, the Washington Post, are about Epstein or President Obama? And not more about the things that have more impact on people?
This is a question I literally ask myself every single day when I wake up, right? Like I cover, when I'm not anchoring, I'm covering the State Department. I go over there every day and it's like Marco Rubio is not particularly scandalous or headline grabbing
right.
as Secretary of State. So people tend to look past whatever he is doing. But he's the National Security Advisor, but he's also the Secretary of State, he is executing the foreign agenda around the world. And whether people are paying attention or not to whatever trip he is on that day or that week, it's all got big implications.
Absolutely.
I've always just as a person believed that policy mattered a lot more than politics. I don't know that ultimately I'm right or wrong on that, but that's just sort of my view of the world. I think that people pay far too much attention to like who said what to who and who tweeted what. It's like it's U.S. foreign policy and U.S. domestic policy that matters.
So let's do what we want.
Okay.
Because it affects the most people. Let's talk about what happened yesterday with Japan. The fact is that they're going to be investing $550 billion here, that they're going to be buying rice from here to give there. The fact that we're going to have American cars in Japan, possibly affordable and a truly true option. I think that's pretty significant with our fifth biggest trading partner, don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, it's a big deal. I had Governor Glenn Youngkin on yesterday to talk about something else, but it I asked him about the Japan trade deal because they're going to be most of the deal's details focus on agriculture investment, which impacts his state, focuses on AI, which in AI investments like server and communications infrastructure, a lot of that's in Virginia. So a lot these things that sound like foreign affairs stories like are not. They're domestic U.S. stories that will impact everything. American jobs and American families.
So I was with, and if you're going to name drop, I can play that game too. I was with one of the presidents of Meta, Vice President Meta.
Oh, actually, great job. I loved that interview with Joel Kaplan earlier. Yeah.
So Joel said to me, we're building data centers in Louisiana, and it's one of the poorest sections of Louisiana, and we're looking to hire people, workers, pipe fitters, electricians, plumbers. And the average salary is going to be $200,000. So I think data centers, cutting edge, AI, what's going to be?
That's
going to
go far
robots.
In Louisiana, too. Right. Like, that's not $200,000 in Manhattan.
We don't have it. And that's part of why Mike Rowe is so valuable at the conference last week in Pittsburgh. Yeah. And he's saying that we're opening these data. And then the people came over and I said, there's a sense that when we make these big announcements from Oracle and from ChatGPT, we're not seeing the infrastructure. And he said, well, we are. And he said, I'm telling you right now, that's our main focus, building these huge data centers to lead when it comes to AI. So I think that's going to be
significant.
And then
you got to power them.
Yes.
You know, like that's the other big push.
And the other thing is that means the Secretary of Energy is one of the most impactful jobs, which is not the sexiest job in the world. And the Interior Secretary, who has a role with energy, and nuclear is going to be a major story. And I think Democrats can get behind that. Do you notice I didn't bring up President Obama, and I did not bring up anything to do with Jeffrey Epstein?
Or Russia.
Right.
You know,
and that was the whole thing. So I think that sooner or later, that's going to have to be the thing that gets traction because there's so much of substance going on right now. Mm-hmm. You can't avoid it. It's like you can't avoid, you could talk about construction, but then when you drive home and you can't use those roads because they're being built, your life's affected. Sooner or later, this has got to be affecting prices of the economy and the direction of the country, don't you think?
So, yes, but so that said, I know that you talk to everybody. What do you think Ghislaine Maxwell is going to say in her interview with the deputy AG?
It looks like by indications with their lawyer, he goes, she's here to help make a deal. And number two is the lawyer praised Donald Trump for wanting transparency to get the whole story out.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I sense my feeling with that story, the Epstein story, is this. And my analogy is there are a lot of people who are great friends with Bill Cosby. They thought he was the best comedian ever. To be have Bill Cosby doing it, to get an interview with him is fantastic. He was a great person, a commentator as well as a talent. Well, he ends up being a guy abusing women, drugging women, going to jail. Does that mean when you were friends with Cosby in 2010 and 2000, does that mean that you should be destroyed? O.J. Simpson was in the elite of the elite. Every hot party in Hollywood was O.J. He was an athlete, he was a comic sports guy, and he was an actor. Turns out to be a double murderer. Does that mean that 1999 picture with O.J. Simpson makes you a bad person? Jeffrey Epstein was a heavy, very respected financier for whatever reason. The rich of the rich, the most powerful, hung out with Jeffrey Epstein. So was Trump. In 2009, they stopped hanging out. He said, the guy's a creep. But the pictures and video make it seem like Donald Trump was working with Jeffrey Epstein to get 10-year-old girls.
Here's my question, since I'm now interviewing you, is why do you think that the Trump team has been, like, if I was their media spokesperson, I would be like, yeah, of course, Donald Trump, his name is in the files. Like everyone who ever met him for 30 years is in the files.
Poorly
by
played.
Name.
It's poorly played.
Like, why don't they just say, yeah, of course you can expect to see his name in the files. That's not what matters. What matters is the contact. You know, like it could be nothing. It could be something. But the fact of his name being in there is nothing to cast blame or aspersions on anybody about.
Jillian Turner here, you're 100% right. It was played poorly. I think they thought they'd just ignore it and give it to Heisman. And because they had so many other things getting through on July 4th, the big, beautiful bill gets passed and the trade deals are done. And he's like, well, Jeffrey Epstein, I'll handle that. I'm just going to ignore that. So clearly that was a mistake. The whole MAGA world, I think that they have overplayed their hand. I think they feel as though many of those people, those strong personalities, think they got Trump elected and they got all this power. And when they're upset with him, they think it's going to rock Trump's world. And I think instead Trump's like, I'm finding out who I can count on and who I can't. Not to kiss his butt, but just because you don't like the direction of an investigation to say I'm no longer, you know, Trump's a horrible person or I'm no longer in support of the administration, I think it stunned him. That's how I feel. But I just think that they played it bad. Now they're like, get it all out. And I also think if you're President Trump, you're thinking to yourself, Stormy Daniels situation, everything that came up with all the background, you go, do I really, I'm not even, I'm going to ignore this. I'm in my last term. I got through five cases. I am not going to go back to 2005, right? I'm not going to do that. And now it turns out 2005 won't let him go.
Yeah.
Lastly, you went to Columbia.
Oh, I did. Yeah. It's
your thoughts about the deal.
I actually think that it's, I think it's a good thing that the school signed onto whatever this deal is with the administration, because I think it gives them a chance to go on and continue. They acknowledged in this settlement that they failed to protect their Jewish students from going to classes on campus, from living in school housing, and now they can hopefully try and redirect, you know, and get back on track to being an academic institution. The schools that are fighting this are going to get consumed by fighting this for the next however many years, and some of these like vaunted institutions might not survive.
When you were there, did you pick up any of that? I mean, never. They talked about bias.
Not a day in my life. I mean, I'm Jewish. I went there. Never experienced anti-Semitism that I can remember, you know, from students, faculty, for anybody. I can't tell you.
Because... It could be graduate school. A lot of people go back for...
All right. Okay, fine. I was there from 2001 to 2000, and I graduated a semester late in 2006 because I took a semester off to work in Washington. So 2001 through 2006, I was a student. Interestingly, when I was there, they created an entire program to recruit and then helped fund Israeli Americans who were older and didn't fit into the U.S. higher education system because they were a few years older than American students in college because they had done military service. I'm sure they got some kind of federal funding for that program. Yeah. You know, they were actively recruiting Jewish Israeli students who had served in the Israeli army.
Did you pick up?
We had tons of Israeli veterans essentially on our campus.
Yeah, you fought in the IDF.
It's like
you're 26 years old, freshman.
It's wildly different now. Yeah.
So, Jillian, did you ever pick up the political bias?
Yes, but I think I was less. If I went back to that school today, I'm sure I would feel very differently. I was not as in tune.
Either was I.
At that time, I experienced it, but I don't know.
I would be like, is that going to be on the test?
Yeah, okay. I mean, like,
yeah,
And I did more like foreign affairs stuff. I did international politics was my major. So I wasn't so much focused on like the U.S. stuff. I definitely, it was a ton of anti-Iraq
because
war.
Part of this deal is that they're going to add some discipline to some of their international programs, their Palestinian and Israeli courses. And when it comes to admissions, they're going to subscribe to no longer applying affirmative action and stop with the DEI. So I think that's part of the deal. I think Harvard could take a lesson from Columbia, but I think we're waiting for a judge to determine. Jillian, thanks so much for coming in.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Did you really enjoy it?
Yeah, it was great to interview you.
Right. You did kind of turn the tables in a bit of a surprise. But then we talked much more about Gutfeld than I originally thought we would.
Yeah, that's true. But good thing nobody was listening and it was just between us.
Yeah, that's true. We were offline on that. Mm-hmm. I'm sure my 200 plus stations, I asked them to turn the sound down. Jillian Turner, thanks so much. When's the next time we see you on TV?
Tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., Fox News Channel.
Sadly, everyone's going to be listening to me. Back in a moment.
Illuminating, intriguing, inculcating.
I know some of these words.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Fox News Audio presents Unsolved with James Patterson. Every crime tells a story, but some stories are left unfinished.
Somebody knows.
Real cases, real people. Listen and follow now at foxtruecrime.com.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, welcome back, everybody. Got a couple of minutes before I get to Senator John Thune in about four, actually about 7 minutes. But here's John Harbaugh. Guess what? He visited the White House. He had a good time. And he told people about it. And he's getting some blowback about it. Let's listen to what the coach of the Ravens had to say.
In the past, Donald Trump has said, you know, denigrating things about Baltimore, including no human being who wants to live there.
Yeah.
You know, as a prominent representative of Baltimore and the
Well, how you frame that question? I would frame the question like, you got a chance to go visit with the president, man. What was that experience like? It was amazing. It was awesome. And I promise you, I root for our president. You know, I want our president to be successful, just like I want my quarterback to be successful, and I want my team to be successful. And it was an amazing experience. You know, it's not often you get invited and you get a chance to do something like that as a family. You know, we were there. My daughter was there. Jim's daughters were there. My mom and dad were there. My mom and President Trump, you know, just seeing how he treated her was really meaningful.
And the coach stayed for over an hour and they had a great time. He's in Baltimore, goes to visit the president, and he's dealing with all blowback from Baltimore. And not that he cares that much, but he did notice it and to say he wasn't really expecting it. Man, coach, can you imagine what it was like the first time? This is nothing compared to what it was like the first time. At this time, 6 months in, everybody was talking about the Russia situation, that Vladimir Putin combined with to Donald Trump to take the presidency away from Hillary Clinton. Now nobody doubts that he belongs to be president of the United States. Nobody doubts the election results. And he knows they're going to be one term and the Democrats are in disarray. Can you imagine what it must have been like then? But I just love that the coach stands by it and other coaches are big fans of his. We know that. We know him and Bill Belichick are extremely tight. They know there was a problem with the George Floyd riots around that time. You know, Tom Brady, I think, is kind of tight with Trump, but he doesn't make a big deal of it. But John Harbaugh, by the way, and the Ravens are going to probably end up in the Super Bowl this year. I think they learned a lot last year, and they were so close, and they got the running game, the long-term situation, and a quarterback amongst the top three in the league that is just about due. But that's it for a different time. And by the way, John Harbaugh, one of the great people that you'll meet in any walk of life. By the way, and extremely successful. Already won a Super Bowl, beat his brother. Senator John Thune is next.
It's the Will Cain Show. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday on FoxNews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss a show. Get the podcast 5 days a week at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Some of the countries have so many countries you can't negotiate deals with everyone, so we'll have a straight, simple tariff of anywhere between 15 and 50%. A couple of we have 15 because we haven't been getting along with those countries too well, so we just say, let's pay 50, and that's the way it is. But remember, we get countries that were closed, always closed. Everyone in this room would never remember any of them to be open. We've offered such a deal to the European Union where we're in serious negotiations. And if they agree to open up the union to American businesses, then we will let them pay a lower tariff.
And then they'll have another major deal. But the fifth trading partner is Japan, and they did work out a deal there. That adds to the Philippines, Indonesia, UK, Vietnam. These deals are done. And the framework with China, and I think they have meetings next week in China. Now, a long way from April when he announced Liberation Day and the market dropped. I mean, for the most part, the market hit. It's down slightly today, but it's at over 44,000. The NASDAQ has been through the roof. The president has passed a cryptocurrency bill. He set up a parameters and barriers and cut red tape. He did the same thing yesterday with AI. And he feels good about where the economy is now, especially after passing making the big, beautiful bill now law. A man had everything to do with that and couldn't be happier and should be pleased is our next guest, Senate Majority Leader John Thune. Senator, your feeling about where we are economically right now?
Brian, I think we're poised for some really exciting things in terms of the economy. As you've seen the president with his policies and working with the Congress, has provided some powerful incentives for people to do business in this country. And a lot of our businesses that have, a footprint, multinational businesses are reinvesting in the United States, bringing supply chains back home. I think that the tax policies we enacted with the One Big Beautiful Bill will further that, along with regulatory policy, energy policy. I think the president and his team are doing all the right things to ensure that America continues to be the place where people want to invest and do business. And I think that has huge upside for the country economically.
So just a Fox News poll, and I think you see the polls, if anything, they are a little tough on Republicans. I don't know the science behind it, but traditionally. So a Fox News poll said only 32% of the country look at the economy as excellent or good. 67% say fair. Now, that is up 2 points from up 1 point from June, up 2 points from April. March, that number was just 21% thought he was excellent. So it's trending in the right direction. But why do you think there's a lag to 50%?
I think part of it is, as you know, we've been working since the president took office on the One Big Beautiful Bill, and it's been coming together. We haven't had a product to get out there and sell. We now do. And I think the Democrats have had the luxury of been, shooting from cover and being on the attack these last 6 months. And so we've got to change the narrative. And that means our senators, House members, the president and his team, we've got to be out there telling and explaining to the American people what's in the Big Beautiful Bill, why it's going to impact them in a very positive way. And I think when they hear, they'll know that. I mean, this was really geared and oriented toward working families, from the tax policy to the child care policy, school choice, these accounts for newborns. I mean, there are so many things in here that are designed to give the American people and working families in this country more incentives to do more for their families and to send less to Washington. So I think it's really a function of us now having and being unified and being out there delivering the message about this. And then I think the American people are going to start feeling it. And ultimately, Brian, that's where those poll numbers change. And that's when the American people start feeling the effects of this. And there always is a bit of a lag effect, but it will happen, and it'll start happening, I think, sooner rather than later.
Did you find can you bring me back to 2017 when you guys passed the tax reform? Could you tell me how it was perceived and when it changed? Because it was good enough that, President Biden wasn't looking to change any of it. He didn't even remove many tariffs that Trump put in place. So can you go to a similar timeline now?
Well, look, I think in 2017, and it passed, it was late in the year, and we were going into the 2018 midterm elections, and frankly, I don't think we did as good a job as we should have getting out and talking about it. I think we just assumed that people would realize the benefits from it, but sometimes
you lost the House.
You've got to get out. Yeah, that's right, and I think the Democrats effectively at the time, and this is what they're trying to do again, is make it about, this is going to be tax cuts or bailouts for billionaires. Nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, of the benefit derived from the One Big Beautiful Bill is going to be felt by people who make less than $400,000 a year, and the people who actually make $400,000 a year get the biggest proportionate benefit from the tax cuts that are included there. So if you look at all these things, whether it's no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, reduced taxes for seniors in this country, for inflation.
Yeah.
There's so many things in here, I think, in the end, that people are going to start feeling. And when they start feeling it, you're going to see those numbers reflect that. But part of it, too, is us getting out and telling the story. And
I think that's part of the reason why you want to get back to town. While there might be some pressure from the White House for you guys to stay in and force the Democrats to vote on some of your nominees.
That's right. And, Brian, the Democrats, this is unprecedented what they're doing. This is the first president in history who has never had, at this point in his presidency, a civilian nominee approved either by unanimous consent or voice vote in the Senate, which is a way of expediting nominees that are broadly supported. And so they are delaying, obstructing, blocking at every point in the process. And so I totally appreciate the president's frustration with what's happening on the nominee front. But the other side of that story, as you point out, is we do need senators and House members back in their districts and states talking about getting out to the events where the American people are, explaining what's in that one big, beautiful bill.
But and didn't Senator Schumer keep you guys late when he was not happy with the pace of the confirmations? Right now, unless you have better stats, which you might, there's 259 positions that are being considered by the Senate, waiting for a vote. 97 have been confirmed by the Senate. That is way below Barack Obama's level.
Well, we're actually above, way above Trump 1. I mean, we're about double the rate of 2017 and ahead of Biden. But the one thing that did happen in 2017, Brian, going into the August recess, is the Democrats agreed to process a bunch of nominees in agreement with the Republicans. So far, they haven't indicated any desire to do that. But we are still going to grind it out on these noms in the coming weeks. And, you know, we're, like I said, we're about double the rate of where the Trump administration was in 2017. And then we're getting no cooperation from the Democrats. But as we head into next week and then beyond that, the month of August, we will do what's necessary to ensure that we get the people across the finish line that the president wants to get into those positions. But, you know, we've got the cabinet through at the fastest pace in 20 years. We've kept the Senate in session, you know, 10 consecutive weeks for the first time in 15 years. And we put up more votes at this time in a legislative session than any Congress going back at least to 1989. I mean, and a lot more votes. We're keeping people here. We're working them. Mm-hmm. We're just not getting any cooperation. And that's I think, what's unusual and unprecedented. And that's why we're going to have to just grind it out and wear them down.
And basically, even though you're in the majority, you need the Democrats to show up, even if they're not going to vote for your guys?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, the Democrats can they could leave town. We have to produce a quorum. And if we get under 50, if we don't have, you know, more than 50 Republicans here to produce a quorum, we can't do business. So it requires every Republican to stay here. And one of the challenges we've had, particularly on Fridays and weekends, is keeping attendance here so that we can win votes or at least have a quorum to do business. So there's nothing about this that, you know, is easy, but it should be a lot easier than it is. And right now, because of the way the Democrats are playing and their Trump derangement syndrome, they're putting up an unprecedented level of obstruction. And I think the only way to beat that is to just grind them down. And we've done that a lot already. Like I said, we're about double the rate of where Trump, the first Trump administration was at this point in his presidency. But as we head into the August break, we need to get a whole bunch more confirmed, and we intend to do that.
All right. So let's talk about how you're going to try to increase the majority or at least hold on to it. In Georgia, they say Senator Ossoff is the most vulnerable. But right now, who are you looking at as the best shot of winning the primary and maybe or walking through the primary for that Republican side of the Senate?
We've got there a lot of interest in the state of Georgia in running, and I know that there are at least a couple members in the House delegation. I think there's a statewide constitutional office holder down there that I think is interested in running, and of course we're hearing too Derek Dooley, who's the son of Vince Dooley, is a famous Georgia coach, and Derek Dooley is a coach in his own right, coach with Nick Saban at Alabama and LSU and some other places, is also expressing interest. So there's a lot of interest in Georgia. Obviously, there's probably going to be a primary there, but I'm hoping that we're going to have a candidate that can emerge not only just from a primary, but also that will be a good general election candidate, because I think Georgia is a great opportunity for us. It's a state that ought to have a Republican, ought to have two Republican senators, but at least we ought to be able to elect one in 2026.
So Doug Collins would have been perfect, but he's got another job right now. New Hampshire, in Maine, do you know if Susan Collins is going to run again?
Well, I don't know that she's officially announced, but we are certainly operating on the assumption that she is. She's doing everything that you would expect a candidate who's running for re-election to do. She's raising money. She's aggressively campaigning or getting, you know, back in her state. And honestly, Brian, she's the only Republican that can win. In fact, we don't have a single elected Republican in the Senate from New England right now, with the exception of Susan Collins. And that state is a very blue state. So she's got a proven record. She's a political survivor. And so I expect that she's going to run. And if she does, we expect her to win.
Every time it's going to be tight. And now in Michigan, Mike Rogers, barely lost last time. Is there anybody? Is he your pick this time?
Well, I've endorsed him, and the National Republican Senatorial Committee has endorsed him as well. I think at some point the president's going to weigh in Michigan, but My assumption is at least that based on how close he was last time, it was literally, you know, a few thousand votes, and he actually was winning until they started counting in Detroit. No big surprise there. But we think that Mike's got the organization in place, donors, statewide name ID, came out of it with a pretty good image. You know, sometimes when you come out of an election, you've been beat up a lot, and he actually came out with and if you look at the polling right now against any of these potential Democrats, he's polling really well. So we think Michigan, we put up a good record of accomplishment and things that he can talk about and raise the resources. That'll be a very competitive race in state for us. And we're hopeful we can pick up a seat there.
All right, let's talk about North Carolina. It looks like Laura Trump, is that what you're hearing, will not run for the Senate in North Carolina?
Well, I think she's making that. You know, definitive out there in terms of a statement about it. But I had a conversation along with the president with her about the possibility of her running, and I think everybody was prepared that I think she would have cleared the field and obviously done very, very well there. But I think she's opted at least that this isn't the time. I think it's something she may entertain at a different point in life. But I think for now, at least, she's taking a pass. And I expect we're going to hear an announcement soon on North Carolina.
Mike Whatley? Would you like to see him in there?
I won't speak for him, but you know, obviously there's been plenty of interest in North Carolina too. No lack of candidates, but I think if Mike Whatley gets into the race, I expect that he'll have a lot of support from the president and obviously from Senate Republicans. We think he'd be a great candidate and hold that seat.
I mean, he certainly understands the business, and his track record in the last election was phenomenal. That's why the president asked him to keep the job as RNC chair. Now, in the Senate, you have a difficult situation. I know John Cornyn was going for the majority leader with you. He didn't get it, but he's a class act, and he's being challenged now by your AG, Ken Paxton. Where do you stand personally about who you're looking for that spot, and what do you think the president, who do you think the president will endorse in Texas?
Well, I think at least for now, it appears at least, and I can't speak for him. You know, that's obviously the president to speak for himself on Texas. But I think at least for now, you know, folks are going to let it play out a little bit. And obviously, I've endorsed John Cornyn. The National Republican Senatorial Committee has endorsed John Cornyn, and we think he would be a great general election candidate. You know, clearly there are people who want to run, who might, you know, fare well in a primary election, but Texas is a big state, very diverse state, and a state which the Democrats would love to target, and I think that's very hard for them to do if John Cornyn is our general election candidate. So as we look at Texas, obviously we're looking not only at the primary, but also how do we hang on to that seat and make sure that it's not a race that the Democrats can target and have success with. So there are a lot of people in the state of Texas who have perhaps other candidates that they're getting behind. But as we look and think about Texas, we're thinking general election and hanging on to that seat.
And what about in New Hampshire? Scott Brown's been on here a couple of times. He's put his hat in the ring. Is he the best candidate to get to flip that seat?
Well, Scott and I are friends. We go back a long ways, and I'm a big fan of his. I think he is out there already, but we'll see. I mean, there may be some other developments in the New Hampshire race. So at least for now, we still see that as a potential pickup opportunity in a state where in a good year, right year, and if we have a candidate that can win not only the base Republicans up there, but appeal to some of the independents that are very active in New Hampshire elections, we could have that also could be a seat we could win. So we're taking that one very seriously, you bet.
Senator John Thune, I saw your Instagram when you're there in a wetsuit doing a backflip after passing the big, beautiful bill. So I know you're happy, even though you're low-key. So thanks so much, Senator, for joining us and giving our audience the up-to-the-minute moves for the Republican Party. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Always good talking to you. Thanks, Brian.
All right, same here. The Brian Kilmeade Show, back with some sad news in a moment.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It is time to take the quiz.
It's five questions in less than 5 minutes. We ask people on the streets of New York City to play along. Let's see how you do.
Take the quiz every day at thequiz.fox. Then come back here to see how you did.
Thank you for taking the quiz.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Wow, it's really sad news. Hulk Hogan has passed away, according to TMZ, at the age of 71. This blows me away. Not only is he a great guy, great friend of the show, he launched this new freestyle pro wrestling league that just signed with Fox Nation, and it was going to be, it's named after him. So I don't think this was anticipated at all. I mean, he looked in fantastic shape. They say it's cardiac arrest. Here's a little of when he was on with us. Let's listen.
Wrestle legend and former WWE champ Hulk Hogan making some noise at the RNC last night. He took the place over and it was rolling. Guess who's on our couch? Hulk Hogan. He will not rip off his shirt, but he'll bring us inside your appearance.
How do you
yesterday.
Know he won't I'm pretty, tear his shirt
I,
off?
I saw the
reverse. He might have Fox and Friends tank top
That's
on
right.
underneath.
I should
right?
have. That would have been great.
Well, Hulk, what was it like out there? You've been
it was
in a big crowd.
You know, it was crazy, B. It was like, I went out there and I felt that energy, you know, and they had a teleprompter. And I don't work off a teleprompter or a script, you know. So actually, like, when I was wrestling, I'd walk out right before the show was live, and the writers would hand me like 90 pages, and they would still be hot. And I'd look at my boss, I'd go, really? And I'd just throw them away.
God, it's sad. Wow, that's just terrible. Well, Hulk Hogan passed away at the age of 71. Hey, thanks for listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Keep it here. Also, hope to see you in Texas, 23rd August, History, Liberty, and Laughs, also streamed on Fox Nation. Just go to BrianKilmeade.com so I can meet you in person. Don't move.
It is time to take the quiz.
It's five questions in less than 5 minutes. We ask people on the streets of New York City to play along. Let's see how you do.
Take the quiz every day at thequiz.fox. Then come back here to see how you did.
Thank you for taking the quiz.